Welcome to
2 o'clock with Kella.
Bring your tea
and leave with more.
Hi.
Hello.
Hey. Welcome back to Gothic fiction.
Woo! I have to admit, I have done no prep for this because I thought I had the Beetle and Jekyll and Hyde notes here. Turns out they're at home. So I'm just going to do this off the top of my head and hope for the best.
Yeah, but I did do prep because one of the books that I haven't read in 5 years and the other in a year. So
it should be okay. We should balance each other out.
Yeah, you're good. I just needed to remind myself. So I've got a highlighted double page sheet. I've been reading up on them.
This is so exciting. I will let you take the lead today.
I mean, it was mainly just reminding myself of the actual characters' names, because I very much know the characters' names for Jekyll and Hyde, because it's not that hard. Plus, you know, I mean, it's drummed into me with doing Jekyll and Hyde at GCSE, shall you? So I, you know, should know.
I don't think I knew that.
Yeah, I did.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah. But the Beetle, oh my God, the only name I remembered was Paul Lessingham, because that's when I was listening to the audiobook of it to catch up. And oh my God, the Beatles' voice saying Paul Lessingham was so scary. Like, yes, yeah. And I was like,
oh.
It was honestly, guys, if you haven't read these books, well, especially the Beetle, check out the audiobook, because it adds a whole new level of creepiness to it, which is kind of the point.
I can imagine. Yeah. Ooh, interesting. Fun.
Is but before we go into those books, shall we do our what we've been consuming?
I think we should. That sounds like a great place to start.
Okay.
Do you want to go first?
Sure. Okay, well, my song this week, or my music, I have been listening to A Version of Smells Like Teen Spirit, and it's by Freedom Fry. And I found it on Spotify has the playlist of Spotify singles or whatever it's called. I was listening to that. Yeah. Or it might have been a covers one. I know, maybe Spotify covers, search out, but there'll be a link to this song anyway on the blog. And this came on and it's so cool. It's very funky vibes and a bit of French in there. So I really liked it. I just wanted something a bit different to study to, because I think a lot of the covers are slowed down versions, aren't they? So it's easier to study to.
Mm.
A fun discovery.
And very fun.
What I've been watching, I've been powering my way through Emily in Paris, because
good on you.
I need to, well, I know what happened anyway, something she told me. I have this thing where if I start watching a show, I have to watch all the seasons. I can't just
see
it. I don't know why. Nothing bad's going to happen. And that's just who I am. It's like the same with reading a book. Even if I don't like it, I have to finish it.
Oh, yeah.
And I loved Emily in Paris season one was the best ever. That was right on my street. Even season two, I was here for. Season three, I haven't been enjoying it at all. And it's been a struggle. I think I'm on episode 7. And I was hoping there were going to be 8 episodes. And turns out there's 10. So
a couple more to go.
Yeah, so I applaud you for getting through it, but yeah, so that is a not recommendation this week.
Yeah,
don't bother with the third season, just don't
put yourself through it.
No, it's not been a relaxing lunch break for me watching it.
Oh no.
Oh, not this good. It's just I don't mind shows being ridiculous, but this is just too ridiculous.
Yeah, definitely. It is a bit too
much. It reminds me of year 9 business studies. I can't explain it any more than that, but I'm this is something that they put on. You know when they make you in business watch Dragon's Den or The Apprentice or something? They would 100% put this on.
Yeah.
That's why it's good. When he said, what's he called? William Aberdee's character, he was saying, so Emily said, oh, do it as a limited edition perfume or something. And he's like, oh, thanks to me for explaining the simple rules of supply and demand. And I was thinking, yeah, thank you. We did that in business. Yeah.
No, that was quite funny, that bit.
Yeah. But I do have actually a really good recommendation for what I've been reading this week. So ooh. I read Olga Dies Dreaming, and I'm not sure how you pronounce her her name. It might be Chittle Gonzalez. I'm really sorry if I butchered that. But it's her debut novel, which I can't believe, because I gave it 5 stars, and if I could, I would have given it 6 stars. It's wow. so good. It only came out a year ago, and it's so hard to categorise. It's one of those books of contemporary fiction, so it's not really... So I've seen it on Storygraph. I think they listed it under either romance or LGBTQ+. But I don't really think it fits into either of those. It's more so the story of a brother and sister in New York and their general life story, their careers, their love lives, their family connections, but also running side by side with that is what was going on in Puerto Rico with, you know, that really awful hurricane they had. I don't know if that one was Katrina. I don't know.
I know the one you're on about, though, because I remember seeing and hearing a lot about it.
And yeah, so there's a whole story about Puerto Rico as well and its relationship with America. And it's kind of political, but it's not a book that's so political that you feel like you're reading some kind of doctrine. It's really, really well done. And as I was reading it, I was thinking, I can't believe that. Like, I remember this happening, but it didn't really register much on my radar. And I felt really awful because it was so bad, like what was happening and how they were receiving literally no support whatsoever. It's such an incredible book. I really, really recommend it. I say even from the last couple of years, it's in my top 3 books. I didn't expect to enjoy it that much, but I really, really loved it.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah. That's a very good book recommendation.
Yeah.
Going straight on my list, that's for sure.
And one last thing I'll say about it that I liked is the characters are about 40, and I much prefer that actually to a lot of the books I've been reading. It's been characters in their 20s, which is nothing wrong with that, but I think it just makes a change. It's a bit more interesting to not have the typical 20-year-old rom-com.
Yeah.
Yes, that is what I've been consuming. Oh. I didn't like it, something I loved. So.
That's a very good little what you've been consuming.
Thank you. What about you, though? What have you been consuming?
About me? Listening... I've been listening to my folk and acoustic mix on Spotify. Ooh. So that's basically lots of Fleet Foxes, Bon Iver, Hozier, Lumineers, that sort of jazz. So I'll see if I can link it on the blog. It changes all the time. But it's just kind of nice, chilled out, vibey songs that I'm quite enjoying lately.
I love that you have that mix close to you, because I think depending on what you listen to, they create different genre mixes. And like, I absolutely do not have that. I think I have one, it's like Hopeless Romantic Mix. So
I can search things. Like, I remember just searching some random words. I think it was like late at night one evening, and I think I just typed in like late night chill, and it came up with a mix it made for me called late night something. Music.
That's so
you can just search like random words and it comes up with a mix that it makes on that kind of mood for you. So it's very good. I do love Spotify.
That's so fun.
Spotify. Watching. I watched Tick Tick Boom last night.
Aww.
Because I wanted to watch something that I knew I liked.
Yeah.
And I just love that film so much. It's so good. The music is amazing. Andrew Garfield is amazing as Jonathan Larson. Yeah. And I just loved it. And it turns out that actually it was Jonathan Larson's birthday yesterday.
Was it?
And I didn't realise till afterwards. So that was a fun kind of little coincidence. I ended up watching that film on his birthday. So... Yeah, and I'm going to try and get Ella to watch Rent with me at some point because she hasn't seen it and I think she'll like it. But yeah. And then reading wise, I've been reading lots of interwar British fiction
Yes,
to
I know.
try and find another primary text to help me with my dissertation. So because of that, I've read Patrick Hamilton's The Midnight Bell, which is really good. It doesn't explicitly talk about the war in any sense, but it's quite autobiographical. And it's about this guy who works in a bar who wants to be a writer, and he ends up falling in love with a prostitute, and it kind of navigates their relationship and his relationship with the other people who he works with. And it's part of a trilogy, with the other two books, one being the point of view of the prostitute and the other being the point of view of someone else who works with him, who is in love with him.
That's so
So
cool.
it's really cool. I really enjoyed it. The other two are less autobiographical, but still really cool. It doesn't work for the dissertation, but it was a fun read nonetheless. And I guess it's kind of helpful because I'm writing about Patrick Hamilton's fiction. So yeah, I would recommend it because it's an interesting look into 1930s life, and he's got an interesting way of thinking and writing. So I'm becoming a Patrick Hamilton stan, basically.
I really enjoyed your review, your glowing review of it. So everyone should check that out.
Yeah, I can't remember what I wrote in the review, but I did like it. Really enjoyed it. So if you're after something a bit different, I feel like we've given very different reading recommendations. You've got a very kind of contemporary, brand new novel, and I've got one that's like 90 years old.
Yeah, you know, on Storygraph, it does the thing where, well, it does a lot of things, but one of
Does a lot.
the stats is what decade your books are from. I bet all of yours would be like there'd be so many Victorian ones on there, like late 19th century, or like kind of the time period you're reading now. But I
Yeah.
just recently, like I've been reading books that are really contemporary.
Yeah. No, I feel like I'm definitely in a kind of 100 years ago books mode at the moment. And I do gravitate towards the older stuff, but I'm sure that will change. And I'm sure it definitely will have to as I hope to move into publishing and will read more contemporary. Anyway, that's me. That's my little ramble over. Apologies, still very full of a cold.
But actually, you know what? I'm gonna stop filing my nail now because it's
Time to get serious.
yeah, let's get on to our intensely literary episodes.
Yes. Heading to the 19th century, what, 1860 something in 1896?
Well, I could tell you. The Beatle came out in 1897.
Oh, so close.
Well, I don't know, you could be right because I'm not sure if that's the novel date or the serialization date. But you
Okay.
could be right. And Jekyll and Hyde was 1886.
86. Okay. So the latter half of the 19th century. In this sector, indeed. Victorian literature, which you know we love.
Love it.
Especially with the kind of gothic mix into it. It's, yeah.
We're slowly covering all the big hitters because we've done Dorian Gray before. And
Yeah.
we did say, well, it's a while away now, but on Halloween we will be getting round to doing Dracula.
Which I'm really excited for because then also we've done Frankenstein as well before, so we would have done all the big ones.
Will have. Yeah.
So we'll have to start getting creative with our podcast ideas.
Okay, should we do a quick summary of the two books then, just in case
Yes.
people don't know?
Yes.
Because I reckon that maybe you'll be listening to this knowing a lot about Jekyll and Hyde, but not knowing about the Beetle.
Yeah.
So I've given a quick overview of both of them to set the scene. Jekyll and Hyde, baby. It's only a short book, okay, and Rutlow Stevenson probably wrote it being high, but who knows? Anyway, so yeah, Jekyll and Hyde. Henry Jekyll is the doctor, and he is incredible. He's a lovely, lovely human. But I've been able to find out his experiments have ended up in him taking some kind of potion where he can transform into Edward Hyde, who is the epitome of evil. But interestingly, the story is told from different perspectives, but mainly Gabriel Utterson's, who is a lawyer and the lawyer friend of Dr. Jekyll. And so the book starts with him walking along with his cousin Enfield, and Enfield's telling him about how this evil Mr. Hyde, who like, we don't know who this is at this point, tramples a poor child, and so he has to intervene and tell him to pay the family. And turns out the name on the check was Jekyll's. So it's a bit of confusion, and they think that to start with, Jekyll is being blackmailed or something of the sort by Hyde. But the rest of the novel follows as Utterson slowly finds out more about what is happening with Jekyll and Hyde. And we hear some more awful things that Hyde has done. And then towards the end, so another friend, Dr. Lanyon, he has to help Jekyll, who gets into a bit of a pickle and can't transform back as easily or whatever. And so he finds out the truth, and he's so shook by it that he actually dies. And so then, well, Utterson reads a letter left by Lanyon and finds this out, or everything that happened, and then reads another letter left by Jekyll, who has now lost complete control and just is Hyde. And it ends with Utterson breaking into the lab and finding Hyde, finding the letter, and Hyde, trigger warning, he commits suicide because he thought, I just can't stay like this anymore. And that's pretty much it. That's the summary. Yeah.
Very good.
And as I said, this really is imprinted on my mind. The amount of revision in year 11. Much to everyone else's horror, I'd stapled bits of paper into my actual book.
Wow, I've never heard of that being done.
I know, it's because I thought, well, actually, Jo, we'll leave that aside. We'll summarise the beetle next.
Okay.
Okay. So yeah, the beetle bit later on, and that's late 90s. This is by Richard Marsh, and interestingly, it was a bigger seller than Dracula at the time. It's surprising that it's gone. Well, it's not out of circulation, but you know, it's not as popular. Anyway,
yeah, we can have a discussion about that.
Sorry. Okay, right. So we start off with Robert Holt, who is looking, he can't get into the workhouse, very poor, all this kind of thing, and he finds shelter in this empty, well, he thinks it's empty house, but turns out there's a beetle in there, but it's not quite a beetle. When we say beetle, that encompasses a lot of different things. So it's more so some kind of human, I suppose, who manages to mesmerise Holt. And he wants him to be part of his plot to take revenge on this politician, Henry Lessingham. And so Holt then, after having this weird kiss from the beetle that mesmerises him, he is sent out on a mission to go and steal some letters from Lessingham. And he does that. And it turns out these are love letters between Lessingham and Marjorie Lyndon, who is, well, she is the daughter of a politician who is the rival of Lessingham. And so the Beatles are planning somehow to use these letters as a form of blackmail. But also at the same time, we have Sydney Atherton, who...
Oh, Sydney.
Yeah, good old Sydney, who fancies Marjorie. And he actually gets on really well with her dad. So he's like, yeah, I'm in there. I'm going to marry her. So he also proposes to her at the start, and she's like, haha, no, I'm secretly engaged with Lessingham. So he's like, oh god. And so then he's a bit bitten, and he's kind of thinking, oh, maybe I will help the beetle, because the beetle tries to mesmerize him as well. There's a whole thing, but doesn't quite do it. But yeah, everyone gets exposed. They find Holt running around and manage to get him out under the spell. But the dramatic end is when they all work out, they go back to this house, Holt takes them to the house, where the beetle supposedly is, and they somehow manage to, like, Holt runs off because he's been mesmerized again by the beetle, and then they leave Marjorie there while Sydney chases after him. But yeah. Marjorie gets, well, mesmerized as well, and they, by the time they come back, they're like, oh my god, like, she's gone, like, the beetle's gone with, like, Robert and Marjorie. So then they have to chase her down at the station, then they're on a train chasing after them.
High stakes.
Well, it's so tense. And at the end, all that remains are these bloody scraps and pile of clothes. And
yeah, because there's a train crash.
Yeah, there's no crashes, so they catch up to it. So they think that the beetle's dead. And the detective, who is Detective Augustus Champnell, he hears that. Also, we do find out the reason behind Lessingham, who I'm now thinking, actually, he's called Paul, not Henry. But anyway, we find out that the reason why he's so afraid of this beetle and the beetle to take revenge, because Paul was in Egypt a few years before, and he somehow got taken into this cult of beetles. And he managed to strangle, I don't know if it was that same beetle, but he somehow strangled one of them and tried to kill them and managed to escape because it was human sacrifice kind of vibes. But anyway, the detective finds out later on that someone's gone exploring in Sudan and they found the ruins of that temple, what he hopes is that temple. So by the end of it, hopefully everything's been resolved.
Or there's just that fear that there is going to be loads more beetles taking over.
Yeah. It's weird. So the beetle is supposedly, like, it can, when it's mesmerizing people, I think it can be a human, but
I think at one point it is described as being a human-sized beetle before it then shrinks to beetle size.
It can look like a human.
But
then it also can look like a beetle.
Yeah.
And it's very ambiguous with its gender, but that's a super interesting to discuss. So
yeah.
I hope
yeah.
That was an okay summary apart from getting football. So there you go.
But it's still definitely worth a read, even though we've kind of told you the plot. I feel like the plot isn't the main driving, isn't the main driving force of the novel, but there's still so much to kind of unpack and see by reading it yourself. So I would recommend that if you're into that sort of thing, do
read it. Because I don't think any of it is a huge surprise what happens. But as you said, I don't think that's the point. It's more so super interesting from an analytical perspective in the context of being like Victorian worries about imperialism.
Yeah, exactly.
And about homosexuality as well. But I think that it's just super interesting to read in terms of it's so creepy and unnerving. Because it's called Imperial Gothic, isn't it? A lot of people have termed it. So
yeah,
definitely highly recommend. I don't think that the plot, like knowing the plot, ruins it at all.
No, definitely not.
Yeah, go and read it because it also is a short book. It's not as short as Jekyll and Hyde,
and it is only maybe 200 or so pages.
Yeah, it won't take long. Yeah, there you go. Okay, so those are our attempts at overviews, but now
you did a really good job.
Ella, would you like to say maybe, like, I don't know, are we going to take the books one by one?
Maybe. I feel like we maybe should take them one by one because a little bit of overlap, but not loads.
Yeah, true. Okay, let's start with whichever one you prefer, and you can just say a little bit about, you know, if you like it or not. We'll start easy.
Okay. I don't actually know which one I prefer. I think I gave them both 4 stars.
Oh, interesting.
If I remember rightly.
I think I would probably the same. I think at the time, definitely Beetle 4 stars, but I think I gave Jekyll and Hyde 3 stars because I was so done with it. But no, I think it's the same.
Yeah, I gave them both 4.
Should we tackle the Beetle first?
Yeah, because I think we might have more to kind of delve into with the Beetle.
Yeah. Okay.
I thought it was so weird and out there, and there was, but also not at the same time.
Yeah.
That I couldn't stop reading it. It was so interesting. And even the way it kind of jumps perspectives, like a lot of these kind of late Victorian novels do, I feel like that added to the mystery element of it. Because, of course, you've got Robert Holt's bit at the beginning before you really know who he is. And then he seems to just disappear for a while as you then jump to the novel. Huh?
And his perspective, or his section and his chapters are really short as well.
Yeah, exactly. So it's kind of whetting your appetite as such to what's going to go on and what's going on with this weird beetle thing. So I thought that was very cool and very clever. And there are some quite funny bits in the beetle as well. Yeah, some of the things that Sydney says are absolutely hilarious. I haven't got my copy with me because I took it back home. But there's one point that Sydney's at a party and some guy comes up to him, some kind of tall, lanky, dweeby guy, and asks him something, and Sydney makes a really funny little comment back to him that just made me laugh out loud, and it's really annoying. I can't remember.
Is that the guy that he then takes back to his lab to show him some kind of experiment he's doing, and then he gets injured?
Yeah, that's the one.
But he's like, oh my god, maybe I do need to help the beetle so the beetle can help this guy. Is that the same guy? See, there's more things that happen that we didn't mention in the overview. It's all this warfare and lab stuff and scientific. Oh yeah, see, it's quite scientific alongside Jekyll and Hyde.
Because there's him trying to make, he's basically made this weird chemical substance that is basically a giant bomb that can wipe out an entire area of people, which is really scary. And he's just so casual about that. And like, I think he uses it against someone accidentally. There's that guy in the lab accidentally sets it off and ends up injuring him. But yeah, madness.
Yeah. Should we talk a little bit about science? As far as our English, well, you do have a science brain. It can take us.
Maybe not so much anymore. But yeah.
As you said, it's just casually mentioned that he's building this massive bomb chemical thing, and yet it's just more so mentioned in passing. The lab is more so like a setting rather than part of the plot device.
Yes, and I think like in Jekyll and Hyde, it's the science is what kind of drives the plot.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
That science experiment that he's doing that causes him to turn into Hyde. It's interesting how they deal with science differently in those ways.
Yeah, I think science and religion, huge themes of both of them. Understandably, yeah. Obviously, Origin of Species, but that was, when's that? 59?
Six. Yeah.
But then didn't he write, Darwin wrote another thing?
Yeah, but that was definitely, Origin of Species and all of Darwin's work was definitely constantly on the minds of Victorians, even into the latter half of the century, for sure.
And all the things that's coming out about, oh my god, what's the word? Begins with H. You know, like the idea that your face is linked to like what, like it reflects your inside. What is the word?
Oh, I can't think of what that's called. But no, yeah.
Let me see if I wrote it down.
Is it phenology?
Phenology? Oh, it could be.
But no, there is something about how the look, like criminals having a certain look, having certain kind of facial features, about being able to tell what a person was like from how they looked.
Why so? Oh, I completely forgot.
I think it's with a P. I think it's a PH.
Oh, is it like, did you say phrenology or something?
Yeah, I think it's something like that.
Because I remember doing that when, like, that comes up when you're talking about eugenics in terms of like Nazism, and yet similar ideas kind of are cropping up back in Victorian times, because that's a big thing obviously in Jekyll and Hyde, like huge, because
the physical differences between the two of them.
Yeah, like Hyde is just, I don't even think that, I don't know who they're talking about, but someone who saw him, it might be Enfield, because Austin asked him, I think, what does he look like? And he can't even describe him, but he's just shivers. And because he's supposed to be, I remember in the first, maybe it might even be the first page, first chapter, the, he's a troglodyte and all this sort of thing.
Mm.
These things. And he's supposed to look like, yeah, some kind of caveman.
Yeah. So there's that idea that they're kind of the more evil ones are the kind of less developed as such, which is interesting thinking, but thinking that the Victorians had. I guess that links to the imperialism element of the beetle and that fear of that kind of reverse imperialism, the reverse, basically the fear that the world is going to come and attack Britain as opposed to Britain, you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Reverse colonization, whatever it is.
Yeah. So the beetle is just referred to as, do they say like the Arab, is that what they call him?
Yeah.
So he embodies, he's just simply like
the other
name, he's othered. Yeah, exactly. And then so we have that, and then we also have, as we said, chemical warfare happening in the lab. And then at the end of the book, we find out that there's been some kind of explosion in like Egypt, Sudan area. And I'm wondering, is there a connection there? And what you just mentioned about the fears of reverse colonization, and is that a thing? Like, is the chemical warfare like supposed leading to, like, will you presume it be used in some kind of situation, like when they, as it says in Egypt at the end, when they've got this huge temple's been exploded, is that like, I don't know, them reinstating their imperialist power? Is that the idea behind it?
I think the ending very much is that reinstating of that. Because then if, say, they would have found the temple kind of perfectly pristine, there would have been that fear that another kind of beetle creature could then come from there to England. So by the fact that it's ruined, make you feel like, okay, you're safe because there can't be any more. The same with the crash with the train. I like to think that instead, like, yes, okay, it does reinstate that. It's like, okay, no, we're all safe, we're all okay. But there's no dead body of this beetle found.
Exactly.
And that seems to be this little seed that there's this kind of false sense of security created, that, oh, it's okay, we've solved this problem, it's not going to happen again. But actually, because you don't see a dead body, you can't assume they're dead, right? And with this beetle, we know how like skeevy and great this beetle is at getting away from these people, so maybe it's just moved on somewhere else.
See, I don't know what Marsh is necessarily saying, as in, you know, is he pro-imperialism or whatever. I don't know, but I mean, the anxieties are certainly there. And as you said, there's definitely leeway that the beetle continues. We don't know. We hope there's an inkling of, he should be gone. And there's all the happy stuff at the end about, like, all the characters being married off.
Yeah.
So there's that. But it still is unnerving. It's not completely closed off. Like, I think with Jekyll and Hyde, like, you know, Hyde's just, he's dead.
Yeah, exactly.
That is done. But it's interesting, only a few years later, like 9 years later, this book comes out and sowing the seeds of discontent.
Yeah, but yeah, the same here. I don't know what Marsh was trying to say or what his views were, personally. Also, I don't think his name was actually Richard Marsh, but I don't know whether I'm just misremembering that. I don't know. That's not important.
Marsh.
But I think it is interesting that it sums it up. It does, it closes it all nicely.
Mm.
Victorian public can't be angry at him, but yeah, it still leaves that little seed there for those who maybe read a little bit more in between the lines, which I think is, it's good. It's ambiguous but closed and clean. So yeah.
Mm. Another thing that I wanted to go back to a bit was about the othering and this phrenology, if that's a word that I can't remember. And like we've spoken about how like it's so obvious in Jekyll and Hyde, with Hyde being literally troglodyte. But
yeah,
it's interesting with the beetle, with actually it assuming multiple appearances. And like, so literally, what is this appearance? How can you tell? Like, it's not as clear cut as with Hyde being like absolutely like deformed.
Yeah.
The beetle's less clear cut, you don't know, which maybe is a bit more concerning and makes it more unsettling. And
like, definitely, because they're kind of defying the categorization in that sense, and that makes people unsettled and unnerved. And the fact that you never get a full description of the beetle in beetle form, in human form, in its weird in-between forms where it's kind of shifting. Actually, maybe you get more descriptions about its in-betweenness when it's going from beetle to human, or vice versa, versus when it's in each of those categories. And I guess that linking, I guess, back to imperialism again, that kind of fear of the other and the unknown.
Not, oh, yeah, absolutely.
The other not fitting into the kind of British, you know, what we know, categories of everything.
Yeah, very true. It's amazing how...
The same with the gender as well. The ambiguous gender elements with the beetle. Is it a man? Is it a woman? It seems to have appeal to both genders of the other people, and it's kind of mesmerism thing, and whether that's linked to sexuality in some way or not, whether that's mesmerism or whatever.
Yeah, I'll just actually, we'll park the gender and sexuality stuff.
Yeah,
we've got a lot to say about that, but before we do that, I was just thinking, you suddenly made me think of the connection between like the beetle transforming between human and beetle states, and also with in Jekyll and Hyde transforming between Jekyll and Hyde.
Yeah,
is Hyde even human? I'm like, it's the same thing of transforming, this transformation, having to metamorphosize in order to like to do your task. And it's that scary, like, you know, that, what did Freud call it, like that unconscious, I don't know what it's called.
I know, because you've got
like all of, it's scary that like all of, everything is, all the bad stuff is just relegated to this like unconscious corner, and you have to go through like a physical transformation to be able to access it, and it's considered unhuman. So it's as if like to be human, you have to like, it's, you're only good. It's so interesting, like there's just so many binaries in this. Like, as we keep mentioning, like the other, like, oh, just othering in general.
Yeah.
And so is that suggesting even then that like this, like who they term the Arab, like is that othering, does that mean like that they're not human? It's amazing how much like entire countries and nationalities, and also because that's aligned also with homosexuality, which we've gone to, like that has just managed to be bundled all into like this one bigger of evil.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Whereas we have so many different, because you don't see any other characters from, well, like outside of the UK, really. They don't even, like, it's not really set in, I don't know where it's supposed to be, Egypt, Sudan, or whatever. It's not even set there. It's just set in London. Like, it's as if they're so anxious they can't even go outside there. And also, it's the same in Jekyll and Hyde. That's purely in London.
It's just in that like one little street where he lives.
Yeah, exactly. And so much of it is like not quite Jane Austen dining room conversations, but like told in. He's just sat in armchairs or told through letters. Like can't even voice it aloud, you know.
Yeah, that's really interesting, and that links to that idea of just this overwhelming fear and worry that they're trying to contain these things within these small geographical locations to maybe try and help make sense of it more. Yeah, and I like that point you made about Hyde being a kind of non-human version of Jekyll and the kind of physical manifestation of all those. Well, obviously he's a physical manifestation of all those bad parts of him.
Yeah.
But I know this was a bit before Freud's time, but I'm sure he had a field day looking at Jekyll and Hyde. I wonder whether he did do any work on it. That'd be interesting to see.
Yeah.
Because I think there definitely is a lot of that being shown, and I think you can see how then the later kind of Freud came up with these things and more of these ideas of kind of how your brain works fits into the rest of this.
What I did in my research come across, I don't know if this was Freud, but something about having different kinds of personality or different parts of yourself. Actually, let me read out what I So there's a theory about like egos, and apparently Jekyll and Hyde represent these different egos as such, and I just found it really interesting. So apparently there's like an ID, I don't know if it's supposed to be id or ID, but that's
Hyde. I think you can say either, yeah, like, id or ID. Because I think that is Freud with his ego and something else.
Yeah, and so, like that is the ID is driven by all these animal urges, that makes sense. And then the super ego is like what are like the super high expectations. Yeah. I also like super ego. So that's just like the society itself, like Victorian society. And then that means Jekyll, because he's the rational one, is just like the ego. So it's super interesting, like this idea of like the actual reality versus like the primal stuff about and how like we have society and like these two completely different characters who are actually one character like battling it out, and Jekyll has to be the one that goes between the societal restrictions and then like the absolute like primal opposite. Like Jekyll is this medium as such, even though he's the good one. I just thought that was a bit...
Yeah, definitely. And this, that whole idea that Jekyll and Hyde, they're kind of the push and pull between them is a kind of maybe a physical representation of the push and pull within people's heads with their own mentality and their own selves, their own desire for good and evil and for what they what they should do versus, like you say, their kind of their just instincts of really interesting. And the questions like that are still kind of being posed and looked at today, because I recently listened to a podcast episode with a psychiatrist talking about how people have a human brain, a chimp brain, and a computer brain, and how all those bits have different roles, have good bits, bad bits, and kind of people having to learn how to mediate those three parts of their brain in order to, you know, exist and function to their highest point. So yeah, very, very interesting.
Also, I just had a brainwave. I think like phrenology is the right word, but also
it's
physiognomy the word I'm thinking of.
I think phrenology is more about the brain and the shape of your head and the different parts of your brain doing things, but I think I think that is about your physical features and how that affects what you're like, which the Victorians loved stuff like that, because there were so many scientific developments in the Victorian age.
Yeah.
And I think we can, you could maybe even link that to the beetle itself. That is like the highest form of this weird like physiognomy, because it's like, oh, it's a beetle, therefore it is totally animalistic and other and not a human and therefore bad.
Another thing, I can't hate, well, I can't claim like this is my thought because it's not. It was someone potentially off Wikipedia, I don't know. But I was reading that the because we talk about like these are Gothic books, but Gothic is supposedly like earlier on in the century. So it's what, like Imperial Gothic, like late Victorian Gothic. Anyway, yeah. If you think about how these earlier books, the Gothic landscape is actually a bit physical, whether it be in Wuthering Heights, the moors, or like the creepy castle, that kind of thing. When we get to these later books, it's actually the body itself or the mind is this scary landscape, not necessarily
yes,
the physical landscape. And I love reading that. Oh, that is so true. That it's now our body that is so scary. I guess with all of the like this Freudian stuff, and also Darwin and people being like worried about reverting back into apes now.
Yeah.
Isn't that incredible that like we reached a point where our own bodies are the things that are menacing to us, and then maybe
yeah, we don't. I think we still see that. Yeah, we still see that today. I think we've now got to the point with Gothic where it's that kind of pairing of both the external and the internal
together.
But yeah, that is a really interesting tracking of the Gothic.
Yeah.
I find it so interesting. I love the Gothic.
But we have spoken a lot about science, to my amazement. But sorry, because I stopped you in your tracks before. Let's get on to more discussion about sexuality, because that is like, I love reading the Beetle purely for that. There is so much to be said for that. So Ella, away you go.
Oh, you put me on the spot now.
Oh, sorry. Well, what you were talking about, like with the Beetle, is gender is ambiguous, right?
Yeah.
I mean, because you don't even know if it's human or it's not. It's like you can't.
Exactly. It's such an ambiguous figure in every single sense of the world. And it seems to have this ability to kind of, I was going to say this pull too, but it's not, it's not pulled to, but it's able to pull people to it with this. It's kind of one step further from mesmerism, which I think is kind of maybe linked to sexuality a bit in it, with both Richard and Sydney, and her name's not Mary, and I can't remember her name.
Marjorie,
yeah. I lost that train of thought, but what do you have to say about gender and sexuality?
I found most riveting is right at the start when we mention when Robert goes in there and meets the Beetle, and when the Beetle kisses him, it's really confusing. Like, is his voice sounds masculine, I think. Yeah. I don't have the book in front of me to find the description, but he also, the Beetle says that Robert has to undress first.
Yeah.
And the kiss is some way of imparting, you know, being able to mesmerize him. So, I mean, they kind of get away with that not being like, you know, too in your face homosexual, because oh my god, the Victorians would not cope. But
no, they wouldn't.
Like, it is pretty much like two men getting on there, right?
Yeah, but they get away with it because of this othering and the lack of distinction with this other person.
But, and also because the Beetle is the villain in this, then it villainizes homosexuality if it is the case that it's more masculine. And then later on, though, then the same thing happens with Marjorie, right? And it's confusing then as well. Like, the is the beetle like still more masculine or feminine? Like, because we hear from Paul Lessingham that in the temple, it's, I think it's like called the high priestess, the beetle in there.
Yeah, it's definitely feminine.
Because yeah. It was used to go in there, right? And then, I don't know, like, later on what it is, but then, like, Marjorie as well is forced to cut her hair off. So, yeah. Once again, in that room, people's genders are, like, in the house, are very ambiguous.
They're well. In this kind of flux state.
Absolutely. And because they're constantly changing, like, there's so many disguises in this, right? So, I mean, like, donning yeah. clothes and removing them. And trying to manipulate each other, whether it be through like mesmerism or whether like, didn't Sydney say something like he had his own form of magic that he could use to manipulate people, scare the beetle? I think he was talking about his science,
yeah.
And like having different identities with even like the names, because the beetle does have induction business when they're asking the woman that he rents the house from, what like who is it from?
Yeah,
because there is some kind of name. Right, and yet they don't know. Yeah, it's just my point is, it's just so much ambiguity, and are incredibly interesting. That like, are they attracted to each other regardless of the gender, and is that shown to be something that's really frightening and unacceptable because the beetle is a villain? No.
Yeah. I think so in a way, because I think this beetle has, like, independent from gender or anything, it has this kind of attractive quality to everyone in yeah. some sort of way.
I mean, to be mesmerised is in a way yeah. attractive, right?
Exactly. And it does seem to be kind of pushing these boundaries of attraction and sexuality by giving this beetle no clear gender, no clear sexuality, yet all the different people in this book are attracted to this beetle
yeah.
in this way. That seems to be making a massive statement about how people don't just need to be heterosexual and how homosexuality is fine and bisexuality is fine. It seems to, even though those kind of words weren't thrown around at that time, I think in a way it does, you can read it as it's making a statement to be like, well, people are attracted to people. This beetle being yeah. is an attractive being.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But then obviously that is kind of twisted with the imperial otherness also mm-hmm. placed onto this beetle that kind of makes it fit more within Victorian standards.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Liking that, because I think if this beetle was from England somewhere, there would be so much more uproar both then.
Absolutely. Like,
then there'd be so much more uproar about that. So
mm-hmm.
I think it's a really clever way of mediating that to make a statement about something in a yeah. potentially politically correct way for the Victorian times, but also not. I don't know if that makes sense.
No, I agree. I think it, I don't know, because you could argue that like he is with mainly reinstating order at the end.
Yeah.
That, as we said, like with imperialism, he's upholding that, right? And maybe the same with heterosexuality. But I think with, as is it, there also being more ambiguities with the ending, the beast not being completely gone. Yeah, it's a gothic book, and so it's one that's playing on anxieties mm-hmm. and it maybe is a bit more like horror style isn't championing these, it's not necessarily being like anti-systemical, but
yeah,
I think like because it, again there are so many ambiguities that it is kind of being a bit like, do you know what, I think maybe we should stop the empire and maybe love who we love. I don't know. Maybe that's too big a leap, but I think he's
not completely clear.
And that's what I really like about this.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. And again, with Jekyll and Hyde, right? There, I think it might have been Jason saying this on one of our lectures, but he was suggesting that I don't know how to phrase it, but it kind of like also is this theme of homosexuality in Jekyll and Hyde, in terms of like the indulging of the self, like,
yes, he did say
masturbation in a way, or like, is there some kind of like, I don't know, it's hard because like Jekyll and Hyde are the same person, right? But there's like indulging each other. Is that some kind of like sexual relationship between two men? But then I don't know, because like it is just the one person.
But I think there definitely have been readings of Jekyll and Hyde looking at it through this kind of homosexual lens, and this, like you say, this kind of this self and indulging in the self.
Yeah.
And I mean, the Victorians had these massive ideas about like the chronic masturbator and how that would turn you into literally a crippled man. So there's definitely echoes of that within Jekyll and Hyde, and maybe that idea that you can't give in to that, I don't know, this idea that maybe you shouldn't give in to your kind of deepest, darkest desires because it's not going to end well for you. Then also there's that more potentially a more progressive side of Jekyll and Hyde to be seen as well. I haven't looked into it or researched it enough to know, but I think it is that.
Yeah, but is it like that danger that Freud warns about of like if you completely push everything to your unconscious and don't accept any of it and indulge yourself a bit, then maybe you will get to that state of being like Hyde, that is really dangerous. So perhaps it is about indulging some of your, I don't know, your sinful behaviors, and maybe what does Hyde do when he goes off, and is like, is there a suggestion that he's having a bit of like a Dorian moment, you know, going off to, I don't know, Limehouse, or going to brothels? Like, who is he meeting? Like, Jekyll isn't married off, you know, like,
no, he's Jekyll's a bachelor.
So I don't know, is it like
that's also an interesting thing I've never thought of. American stuff, I think there was maybe a Hawthorne and a Poe story that deals with kind of science and femininity, and how science is seen as a feminine, as feminine, and therefore the man can either pick to have a wife or be a scientist, because he can only deal with one feminine influence in his life.
I think there's a
short story by Hawthorne about this woman who has a birthmark on her face.
Yeah.
And she gets married to the scientist, and he spends this whole short story trying to convince her that she should get rid of this birthmark off her face, and then he ends up killing her.
Oh, really?
I'll find it, I'll link it on the blog. But I think there is this link between going back to science, but also linking it to gender, this science of femininity and these masculine figures not overriding their lives with too much femininity.
And would we say that both books are quite progressive in especially Jekyll and Hyde, warning what you could become if you aren't true to yourself? And so it's saying like, look what you could become if society represses you this much, if you constantly have to follow societal conventions.
Yeah, I think Jekyll and Hyde definitely does, because it's, if you let society repress you this much, you're going to turn into a Hyde and therefore be a terrible person, live a terrible life, and end up not wanting to live, essentially.
Yeah.
But then again, I don't know how much Robert Louis Stevenson thought about that, because I do know that he wrote the first draft of this book on a cocaine binge. Gave it to his wife, she read it, and she was like, yes, it's all right, you should rewrite it. So he, I think he literally burned it and rewrote it again. But no, I do think there is a progressive element to it, for sure.
I'm just going to read through my little notes, research, and just see if there are anything else that I wanted. Oh, okay. These are just some brief points. So, when the beetle kisses Hole at the start, that kiss actually weakens him, which, again, interesting that indulging in, well, I don't know, I mean, because that's more like sexual assault, isn't it? But, like, they're interacting with like, him, if the beetle's, like, masculine in that situation, that then, like, kissing him, that's a form of weakness as such, or, like, weakens him. You know,
interesting.
So I didn't really think about it like that. But yeah, that is interesting. Let's see. What else? Okay. Oh, did you know that Jekyll and Hyde is supposedly religious allegory?
I don't think I did. No.
I didn't ever really think about it like that before. And, like, is it supposed to be a super moralistic tale, though? Because it's not like it reads like a fable.
Is it trying to tell you to not have these bad parts of you? Because if you let yourself have one bad thing, it will just keep mounting up and then you will turn into Hyde. So, yeah, you should just live a very good life through and through so that you stay as a Dr. Jekyll and don't allow yourself to grow this Mr. Hyde figure in your life.
Yeah.
I don't know, that's only off the top of my head, so I don't know if that would work, but I want to get to that more because I hadn't thought about it as a religious allegory.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought about religion in Jekyll and Hyde much at all. It was more about the science.
Yeah. It's really nice. I'm not sure what my thoughts are on that, but I thought it's interesting to bring up.
Yeah, but definitely.
I don't know. Yeah. There is also a religious aspect to the beetle, though, you know, in terms of, like, I guess just with, like, again, like, the Arab and, like, the it being some kind of religion, this cult or temple with the beetles and high priestess.
Yeah. And
it's very non-Christian, clearly. And
yes, yeah, so it seems like there's this threat of this non-Christian religion.
Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Very interesting. Oh, and another random tidbit for you is, so obviously the beetle was serialized. But it was, I think, it might have not been until it was published in one volume that it was called The Beetle. I think as the serial appeared in like, papers, it was actually called The Peril of Paul Lessingham, The Story of a Haunted Man. Now, I find the title change super, super interesting. I don't know if it's, like, more related to marketing in terms of, like, with having one volume, like, it's easy to sell one volume as the beetle.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, the peril of Paul Lessingham, that suggests more of a journey and going across, like, you know, each edition, like, of the paper. But I really like that, like, the change from it being centred around Paul
and the being centred around the beetle.
Yeah. Like, why do you do that? Like, is that, you know, cynically, is that just a marketing thing? Or not?
It also makes me question aspects of the book as well, because it's hard to categorize who the central character would be aside from the beetle. I think all the others seem to have an equal footing. So it's interesting that it was originally Paul Lettingham's story.
Yeah, because just Paul, is it ever from his perspective? Because I'm pretty sure, like, so it starts with, like, Robert's perspective.
I think Paul is the only one who we don't see his perspective.
Isn't it like, so
that in itself is interesting.
Isn't it Robert, then Sydney, then Marjorie, and then the detective at the end?
Or detective, yeah. We never get inside Paul's head, which is interesting.
Yeah, Never Pools, and never really the Beatles, and Zimley and Jekyll Hyde. I mean, because it's mainly Utterson, but also you do get like the letters, you get Dr. Lanyon, and then you have Jekyll's letter at the end, but you don't get
Hyde. You don't get Hyde.
Like, that is really interesting. Both these books have these multiple perspectives, which is what you started with, talking about the structure. Yeah. Is that a bit more frightening? I don't know. Like, what is the purpose of having these multiple perspectives? Is it kind of like piecing things together? Like, everyone's got part of the jigsaw. Is that slightly more frightening? I don't know.
Yeah, and I think maybe in the Beatle, in that sense, it works to kind of, there's not a solid linear narrative straight from the beginning because of how Robert's bit counteracts with Sydney's section that comes after, and how it kind of leaves you questioning and wondering and trying to piece these things together. I think in a lot of the other Victorian books that you and I have both read, the multiple perspectives add to that, trying to piece it together, form the puzzle, bring the reader into the story.
I
like that a lot
like the detective structure a bit, like with the woman in white.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, because I guess these are, you could categorize them as mysteries, I suppose, so that would make sense.
Yeah, they do have mystery elements to them.
Very interesting. Again, it is a mystery. Why? What I started off saying is, why is it that the Beatle was literally more popular than Dracula at the time, and now no one, like, it's not really a thing? Like, why don't we hear about this?
I don't know, and I don't know why it didn't stay popular. I don't know whether part of it is because it's a lot easier to represent, I guess, thinking about films and TV, because I guess in the early 20th century you had like Dracula films and whatever, as opposed to Beatle films. And I think it's a lot easier to depict a vampire as opposed to this weird shape-shifting ambiguous beetle
which
doesn't ever hold a form.
So true. Yeah.
So I think partly that's why, because I think when visual media became a thing, it was a lot easier to transform these stories that had kind of quite solid, like, oh, you know what a vampire looks like. The descriptions of Dracula are very clear, as opposed to the beetle. And I think maybe that's partly why it fell out of the game. Maybe people's fears of imperialism and colonialism weren't as strong as, like, after the First and Second World War and things like that. Maybe that wasn't as big a threat, therefore, I don't know. What do you think?
I think that is such a good point. I think it completely comes down to visuals. Well, people probably have other different reasons, scholars, and that. But it's a good point that you made, that a vampire is so much easier to have as, like, this public image, you know, like in the public imagination. And same goes for even things like Dorian Gray, because easy, it's just human and he's got a painting. And same with Frankenstein, it's a monster. Yeah. When it comes to a beetle who's constantly shape-shifting, and the idea of, like, looking, like, are they looking at, like, a scarab beetle? Like, is that scary?
No, yeah, exactly.
I wouldn't say that it's necessarily, like, more complex, the story or the character, but I think it's not easily summarized or symbolized, you know? So I agree with you, I think. So that makes it trickier to, like, easily pass down, which is a shame, because I really enjoyed it. I wish it was still as popular. I actually controversially enjoyed it more than Frankenstein. So
I really enjoyed it as well, and I think part of that is because it's just so bizarre and so all over the place, but also so you can still follow it and you still get what's happening. But
I loved it, because this was the last book that we had to read for our sex scandal sensation module, and wow, what a scandal this was. I loved it, like the scandal of this beetle running around London unearthing, like, love letters from this MP. Brilliant.
You've got that point where it's like He's carrying what looks like a human on his head through London to try and get on this train. I mean,
if we had time, like, that's a whole other thing about the trains.
And how technology plays into all of this.
Technology.
But we do not have time, but we highly, highly recommend you reading this. It is so good, and I wish more people knew about it.
Yeah, and also, if you haven't actually read Jekyll and Hyde, because it's one of those things that, like, everyone knows about Jekyll and Hyde, but maybe you haven't actually read the novella. Again, it's so short, so easy to read.
It's literally 70 pages.
Yeah, exactly. So I definitely recommend reading that one as well. Just read both of them. It's a fun time.
Definitely, definitely. So much fun.
Yeah. I know, and we didn't even get it down to nitty-gritty of the language. Like, I pulled a couple of quotations. I was like, maybe we'll analyse that. But wow, see, there's just so much to unpack from these very short, I mean, yeah, they're not even novels, they're more like novellas. So if you can imagine how much we've been able to unpack without even doing a deep dive into the language.
Absolutely crazy. You're in for
an absolute treat.
Yeah, honestly, we might have to do a part two. Okay. On that note, what's happening? No,
I think it's time we move on.
I think it's time we move on and close out with our blonde moments for the week.
Yes, let's.
So, Kerry, who does your blonde moment go to this week?
Okay. My blonde moment goes to Jennifer Doudna, and she's an incredible lady because she helped to develop a genetic engineering method called CRISPR. It's an acronym, I think. I don't really know what it is. But it really helps, like, with babies to, like, if they've got HIV maybe, or like cystic fibrosis, what else? Or sickle cell anemia, Huntington's disease, loads of those things. So supposedly this method of genetic engineering helps to, like, eradicate them somehow. Wow. I don't know. This has turned out to be a really heavy science episode, and I don't, that's my thing. So yeah, but I was like, that's pretty incredible. I was just looking at more like these big women in STEM, you know, trying to find out more. And she came up, and I thought that was a super interesting example. And she's a professor, I think, in California, I think at Berkeley. So I definitely shout out to her. Incredible work there. I'm sorry that I haven't been able to do it justice, because not 100% clear on it. I have my GCSE biology knowledge, and that's about it. But it sounds very impressive.
That sounds very impressive. Wow, I have to look into that. I mean, these scientists are doing some incredible things constantly. I'm always amazed.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. Okay. Who does your blonde moment go to this week?
I guess a slightly more somber note. I was going to give mine to Nicola Bully. She's the lady who went missing walking her dog in, I think it was Lancashire, and they still haven't found her. It's been over a week or so now, and they're searching the river and everything, and it's just really horrible, really tragic that this happened, and I really hope that they're able to find her or find out what happened to her soon, because I dread to think what her family and everything are going through. So goes to her, and hopefully they'll be able to find her and give some peace of mind to the rest of her family and everyone else in the country who has got behind trying to help find her. So
just taking a moment to think of her and sending her thoughts and prayers. Okay, so thanks for listening to another episode, and we will be back with a similar episode on Halloween about Dracula. But we will be back with a Netflix episode, a film episode. We're going to go for The Good Nurse next
week. Which mixes science in a little bit, but also bit of true crime, bit of something unlike we've ever done before.
It's very unlike us.
Very unlike us. We're trying out new things, so yeah.
It will be good. We'll see you then.
We'll see you then.
Thanks for listening to
Tea O'Clock with Keller.
See you next time.